views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the views or endorsement of any entity. Nothing being said on this podcast should be considered as investment advice.
All right, let's go. GM. Happy Friday, everyone.
We did it.
Happy Friday.
Another week down.
This was... act like we're like just barely surviving.
We're barely surviving out here. No, this was a good week.
This is a great week.
This is a lot of exciting stuff happening in our part of the internet, our Web3 space, our culture and consumer corner. A lot of really nice price action as well, just on the greater macro space around crypto. So just very positive stuff.
We got a lot to cover today. So we obviously, Derek Clapp Currency here with me is per usual. And we got Amanda, who's Proof's head of culture and community.
Nice.
Is that a new, did I add a head in there for the first time?
Let's go. I just got a promo.
Just like, there you go.
There it is.
Instant upgrade.
Easy. Let's go.
We got Sam remotely, who is Proof's director of research. There he is. Sam, you're on fire today, man. You microdosing? What are you doing?
Just trying to add some energy, you know? It's weekly. We got to add that energy.
I love it. We got Eli, who is Proof's head of art.
I cannot compete with that.
Do a little thing.
Let's go.
Yeah,
you got the fresh cut, though. It looks good.
Yes, it looks good.
Yeah, let's go.
Eli's got the pinky ring on today, I noticed as well, too, which is nice. Is that a new flair for you, Eli? Is that something new?
This is, I'm in a new season of life.
He's not showing it. Look at that.
This is going to be fun.
Why don't you show it to the audience?
Show us the pinky.
Show us the pinky ring.
What do you got? What do you got going on here?
All right. We are doing this on multiple platforms. So if you're watching us on YouTube, make sure to subscribe and say hello in the live chat. Because Amanda, you're going to be watching the live chat, and we're going to be doing a little bit of a giveaway thing here as well in the live chat on YouTube. And if you're watching on Twitter, drop us a reply. We'll be paying attention to that as well. We'll get into this in a second. So I think that was all of the introductions. We're good to go there. I wanted to tell you, today it's fall. Do you know what I'm wearing?
That's called a scarf.
Yeah, but do you know what this is?
I don't know what kind of scarf
it is.
Dude,
that's Tiger Bob.
Oh, that's awesome.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, that's so super cool.
So I picked this up last year. Tiger Bob, this was a release that she put out that is printed cashmere, and it's really, really freaking awesome.
That's
cool.
Awesome.
It's like
she's been absolutely crushing it with her latest stores.
Physicals
and
drop.
You were telling
drops.
Me she's doing a lot more physicals.
Yeah, a lot more physicals. She just did a drop with Transient. And it is going to be a high of 88 today, so it's not so much fall. Kevin just wanted to rock it, and that's fine.
Listen, I was like, I knew we were going to be talking about the Proof hat today.
The
scarf and T-shirt is a combo we don't often see.
All right, listen, it's fall. I don't care what you say. It's not going to be a high 88.
It is.
70. Yeah, you're right. Okay. All right. Let's move on. Today we have later on the show, we have a couple special guests, Luke Shannon and Jesse Woolston from Notes of a Neutron Star.
Yes. And Jesse is here live in the,
awesome.
In our studio. And I'm super excited to have him on.
So great to have him here in studio. Eli, can you tell us a little bit about that project actually?
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun. This is coming up next week, October 26th. The minting opens for Notes from a Neutron Star. But we had our event last week. I think it was last week. Time is compressed and in this weird vortex these days, I feel, in London at Frieze with Pace Gallery to celebrate CP1919, which was this new work from Peter Saville, who was on 100 Proof last week, had this great conversation with you guys and with Sam. And now Aaron Penne, Jesse Woolston, and Luke Shannon, the latter two who are on the show today, have reflected on Peter's work and Peter's body of work over the years to create new pieces that, as I said, are dropping with us at Proof next week. So excited to dig in with the two guys today, and then we'll have Aaron on a live show next week as well. But looking forward to that.
Yeah, fantastic. This could be a really cool drop. Super excited for it. And you know what's funny? I don't know, Derek, if we obviously you and I think we were chatting about that drop, the CPE 1919, mm-hmm. and it was done on Pace. And
yes.
you know, just in full transparency, there was a little bit of like it was $100 to mint it. Remember we were trying to mint it?
We were eating burritos and trying to mint.
we couldn't do it because there was a KYC process yes. and there was a bunch of other stuff and there was a lot of and so there actually wasn't that many minted.
Oh,
which
no
is
kidding.
Crazy. And yeah. so it's like I tried to pick one up in the secondary and it was really expensive because I don't know what it was, Eli, how many there was total minted if you know off the top of your head.
I think there were 287, something to that effect, and they were $100 each. I haven't checked secondary, so you tried to buy one.
I did, and I saw one was like at a half ETH or something like that. And
interesting.
Because these were $100.
Yeah.
And it was just because people couldn't get over that hurdle to mint them, which was a bummer. But
Florida's it was cool. 0.75 now.
0.75. Damn, Derek, you're flooding today, dude. Look at Derek's roll on the cuff of the legs.
All right. Looking all right, good. Enough of that.
All right. So we'll get back to that interview. This is Friday. It's live, people. It's not edited, as you can tell. Let's chat about the hat giveaway. So we are going to do this fun little thing today. It is totally random. It's just for fun. I found a case of, not a case, I'd say, they sent us probably 10 to 15 mm-hmm. Original Moonbird hats that were printed for us when we had just launched Moonbirds. And they were full. I'm wearing one right now. They're totally blacked out, so you can barely see the Moonbird. But if you look at it, it was a misprint. There was like half of it was printed and half yep. of it didn't quite make it. And so, of course, we had to just like scrap them. We weren't going to sell these or give them away or anything. They sat in a warehouse for over a year, and we dug them out and... You know, now they're kind of fun.
Misprints are cool.
They're kind of misprint OG, like, you know, rare things that never, ever existed in the real world. So we're going to do a little raffle today at the end of the show. Amanda, you want to tell us more about what people have to do to qualify for that raffle?
Yes. So we are going to throw a little trivia. We've done this before. So we're going to have a little trivia about the artist spotlight that Eli is going to be doing at the end of the show. We're going to ask you a question. Make sure that you are paying attention. If you know the answer, just throw it in the comments on YouTube. First person to get the answer right will win. That's that. So stay tuned at the end of the show. We'll ask that question. We'll get it done. I think we're going to have Kevin and Justin just sign the hat too. So it'll be a nice extra limited edition little gift for you guys. So looking forward to that.
Definitely Justin. He was the artist. He gets all the credit. He did I was the one that screwed up the actual hat. So maybe I should sign it too.
You're the one that screwed up the order.
I screwed up the order. So I'll sign it as well. All right. So Sam, I would love to check in with you and get a market update. What's been going on this week?
What is going on, everybody? Yeah, just going through a quick update here. I think this volume chart, I almost feel like I should stop putting it here. It's just, I don't really think there's a ton of information in it, but this looks at every single week this year. So it does kind of give you a feel of how volumes kind of have trended over the year, how down they are, but you know, a little bit up from the past couple of weeks. If you look at prices, which is the next slide, you know, large cap PFP index, you know, kind of bottomed a few weeks ago and has been flat to up a little bit, had a bit of a nice move yesterday. So that's good to see. The Art Blocks index, which is the Art Blocks index, just this kind of keeps trending lower. You know, today we had 10 Chromie Squiggle sales, but even so, the floor price went a little bit lower. So you're just kind of a bit of a steady kind of, but very slow down move there. Looking at the next slide, some of the top sales this past week, we had a Ringer sale yesterday for 30 ETH. So that is cool to see. There was a Gazers, this was a slate background, which sold for 17.3. Of the 10 Chromie Squiggle sales yesterday, this ribbed one here, it's, you know, was a 14 ETH. So well, pretty nice
the right
sale.
Slide that was up. Expensive. Oh, there we go. Yeah, there we go. We got up now. Okay.
Oh, sorry. And then bottom right, I put this Life in West America by Rope Renisto. This project has kind of seen its floor steadily rise, just quietly. You've had a bunch of sales. The floor has gone from like 3.5 to 5 ETH, and there was a nice 4.5 ETH sale this week for that. The next slide here looks at one-of-one sales and some really cool one-of-one sales this week. First of all, top left, that's Matt Cain's Anon. You know, he launched four Anon NFTs a few weeks ago, came back and did another collection this week, and this one called The Zombie, because the way that
guy looks, sold for 10 ETH. A really cool piece by Patrick Amidon, upper right, called "Unknown in a Train." It's a motion NFT. But this one sold for 10 ETH to Satoshi, I believe. In the lower left, this one's called "Split Personality." This is an NFT that actually minted in 2020. It sold for 7 ETH then, and then today or this week, it sold for 10 ETH by Quasimondo. And I wanted to put this piece by Elon Derek because he's a good friend of Proof. He has a very signature style, but he's recently released this kind of new collection that has a bit of that Rafik look and feel, you know, a lot of movement, really cool colors. And he's had a bunch of sales at 3.5 ETH, 2.5 ETH, some of the top collectors picking that up. So that is all very cool to see.
Oh, I was just going to say that I love that Matt Cain. When was that? When did that Zombie Anon actually get created? Is that relatively new?
Yeah, he created, well, he's done this Anon project where he had four basically old, you know, kind of photos, and he did a lot of editing and processing on them. And the top one is called the Anon. That's what this is. And then there are other multitudes, which is seven or eight more. And he did four at first, and now he's just tacking on individuals one by one. So this was just minted this week, and there was an auction, and the top one sold for 10 ETH.
Very cool.
That was the drop that he did right before the super rare drop,
right? Right.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah, exactly. And so now he did four, and now he's just doing a few more. Just a few more slides on interesting stuff going on. Cargo by Kim Asendorf. Now, I've been looking at a lot of art. I showed earlier, you know, art blocks haven't been that hot, kind of steady to slightly downward. But then you have this from Kim Asendorf, the Cargo Project, completely pumped. I know, and you guys are both part of Flamingo. I know that Flamingo had a big sweep there. But even before that, this has just been completely on fire. So super noteworthy there. The next slide is Winds of Yawanawa. Obviously, just the most in conversation kind of art project out there. I believe Flamingo swept that as well, or did some buys there. But got up to about 13 ETH, fell back to 10, and now is kind of holding that pretty well. In terms of other cool projects, the next slide here is Snowfro with Velocity Pass is releasing these NFTs. You know, the bid right now is about 0.7 ETH for them, and they come with stitch instructions. So you can make your own hat. Again, this is in conjunction with Velocity Pass, which had a very successful drop with Per Christian Stovland a few weeks ago. So following it up with Snowfro is pretty awesome. And then the other thing in Snowfro news is the next slide here, which is Opepin. This is Jaleel from Opepin, but Jaleel and Jack Butcher both tease the idea of an Opepin kind of with a chromy squiggle feel, with a chromy squiggle theme to it. That was teased yesterday by both of them. Price of Opepin went up about 15% on the back of that. You know, Opepin did their partnership with Penguin, so this would be awesome. And then two other quick things I'll talk about. If you go down one more slide, Matt Cain. These are called Souvenirs by Matt Cain. Obviously, Matt Cain had a very kind of highly discussed, controversial drop with Super Rare. He decided that he was going to drop these action figures to people who had the super rare ones. He dropped different ones based on whether or not you paid royalties, if you sold it, if you held it, stuff like that. But kind of interesting, novel stuff. And I know we're going to talk about that from Matt. And then lastly, last thing to talk about, and I think the biggest story on our timeline right now, is this Sketchbook A Mint Pass by William Mappan, which he's dropping in an hour and a half. So we're basically at towards the closing line for this auction, but we'll go into the details. But currently the lowest bid is $5,000, which I believe is 3.1 ETH, something like that. So love to see that. Just cool stuff from William. And I know we're going to kind of continue talking about that there.
Yeah, awesome.
That's all I got.
That was a great roundup.
Yeah.
I learned new things. I got to see some data behind some of the themes that I saw on Twitter. Sam, got to hand it to you, man. These are great.
Yeah, that was awesome.
I appreciate that.
All right, so this is breaking news. Xcopy this morning just did a new post of a drop that is going to be a one-on-one, I believe.
Is that true? Do we know that for sure?
No, I just made that up.
Okay.
But I can't imagine. Is this going to be an addition? It didn't say it. He said that he was minting it on a manifold and putting it fully on chain with some extension of manifold that I hadn't heard of or seen before. But this is, I mean, to me, this just screams like classic Xcopy. Mm-hmm. If you can't quite see it on your display, there is a whole head of a skull kind of blacked out in the background there. So, you know, up your contrast a little bit, but it's a really, this brings me back. This makes me feel classic X. I love it.
Yeah. I love it too. I am a fan. I love Xcopy. I think Xcopy is one of those artists that we'll just keep pointing back to as one of the main folks that really started bringing about the crypto art movement and was a pioneer in many ways. And I love seeing him continue to play with the medium and try new things and drop new work. So this one feels particularly in line with his style.
When I see that piece, I'm just like, I immediately want to buy more X copy.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Do you own any X copies at all?
I do not. Still need to get a Max Payne.
Max Payne's the way.
Like just that. I mean, I've had a Max Payne. I've sold a Max Payne.
Did you make money?
I did. I minted one. And then sold it, and then I got to come back again. I think you got to own something from XCopy, and I think that's what's kind of cool is that we had the background, right?
Yeah,
I think we encouraged some people to buy one and hold one for the cool background, but now they also own, you know, an XCopy. So I think it's cool that we're trying to at least encourage a little good collecting of some classics.
Yeah, if you own a Max Payne and a Moonbird in the same wallet, it will enable an in-chain, on-chain background for, got to be careful which chain you mentioned there, get in trouble. You'll get one on a background of your Moonbird, and it's not, we didn't create that.
Yeah.
XCopy created that and sent it to us, and then we put it in chain.
Have I told you guys about my XCopy visor?
No.
I haven't?
No.
Oh, so if you go to my Twitter banner, you'll see that my Mebit is wearing this visor over his eyes, and it is a 1 of 10 XCopy visor that he made for CryptoVoxels way back in the day that I found when I was crate digging on that contract, on the Voxels wearables contract. It's really deep in there. It's hard to sort through it. It's like an 1155 contract, but there's 10 of them. They very rarely trade. And I sniped one, and I'm excited about it.
And you just took the file and...
Yeah, I just like Photoshopped it together. But what I think will eventually happen is somebody's going to, you know, index that contract, and you'll be able to use the visor in immersive environments. I've talked to the Mona guys about it, and I think they'll figure something out in the future. So that's my XCopy visor.
Cool.
Hey, Derek, just quickly, you know, we've seen obvious, and you guys have talked about it over the last few weeks, Rafik going into the MoMA. We've seen CryptoPunks in different museums. We haven't really seen that with XCopy work as far as I'm aware yet. But you describe it in this reverence of, you know, we're going to look back at his work ultimately and him as this pioneer of crypto art. Why do you think there's been that disconnect so far, at least?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I think what we've seen so far, at least on like the institutional side, being able to pattern match to the artists that they're kind of bringing in and enveloping in sort of like the institutional movement or through the institutional lens. I think Rafik has been making work for audiences outside of, let's just take Rafik as an example, has been making work outside of the crypto space, the blockchain space for a very long time. He's been in dialogue with these institutions.
Yeah, I mean, he's out there shaking hands and kissing babies, and X is anonymous.
X is an anonymous artist. He's kind of a weird guy to pattern match to. So my view is, you know, and this is, you know, part of the thesis of Glitch. This is what I, you know, try to work on every month, is being able to tell the stories of really like how this industry was built. And XCopy, there was a reason why we started off every 30 days with XCopy and right click and save as guy and borrowing that work from Cosmo to showcase for 30 days at Glitch. It's because we really feel that X is a pioneer for and a reason for why many of us are here today.
So cool. I took a picture with XCopy when I had coffee with him, but it was on his phone. So I said, hey, if you ever come out 10 years from now, like whenever that happens to happen, then you can send me the picture of us together. Because I didn't want to make him think like I was going to leak his photo or something, right? So anyway.
That is amazing.
All right. So William Upon obviously just has been on fire for the last, gosh, year plus now, it feels like. And he's been relentless about just doing new drops, pushing boundaries in new and creative ways. Every time I look at his Twitter feed, it's an example of one where I'm just like, damn, this guy has talent. Mm-hmm. Like, because he's posted a lot of stuff that he hasn't minted yet. Mm-hmm. And 100%. You just look around and you're like, this is so good.
Yeah.
And so this new collection, Intimacy, is a really fun mechanic. Who wants to walk us through the mechanic? Probably Eli or Amanda? Do you want to walk us through this?
Eli, you do it.
Head of art.
You want me to do it? Okay, sure. Let's do it. I'll try to keep it pretty concise because I think most of our viewers probably have a sense. Yeah. So the way that this works is that there are a total of 64 NFTs available. 4 of those are being held back by William to his own collection. So there are 60 available to the public. And the way that it works is that there is an auction for those 60 mint passes. But as a collector, what you can do is you can explore the algorithm. So you can go in into their interface and you can generate outputs from the algorithm, and you can save those, you can favorite those, and you can generate 20 at a time. So you can really create this robust collection for yourself throughout the algorithm. And then if you are one of those 60 people who win the auction that Sam mentioned at the top of the show, and which is happening right now, you can then choose one of your outputs that you have generated from the algo to mint as your piece, to mint as your NFT, the one of 64 in that collection. So there's a bunch of elements of this that we should unpack. Like, it has taken over my feed in terms of people generating outputs, sharing outputs. The founder, one of the co-founders of Verse this morning, where that's the platform where the sale is happening, tweeted that there's been over 1.2 million outputs generated and around 250,000 outputs saved or favorited. So it's this really interesting co-creation, a form of co-creation mechanic. And the piece, and then I'll pass it over to you guys, the piece that I love most about that is that most collectors in this space are quite novice collectors, right? They were not, and I'm including many of us here, collectors of art 2, 3, 5 years ago. And so mechanics like this that allow someone to explore the art, explore their own creativity, sit with the artwork, sit with these outputs, evaluate them through their own lens. There's no traits. So you have to identify what's maybe rare, independent of those attributes. I like it through that lens in particular. It's this opportunity for collectors to spend a lot of time with William's work and really get to know the edges of that algorithm in a way that I think is ultimately really interesting.
Yeah, Eli, one of the things, I was in there and I was generating a bunch of them, and, you know, 20 at a time. I found a couple that I really liked. I'm not going to bid on these passes. I just, you know, it's going to go. It's going to finish without me. But you can take that seed, that actual output that you favorited, that you love, and you can request a print where you don't get an NFT, but you buy a print. So you get a physical, and he's going to sign that as well, right? And that's an open edition, more or less. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I think that might be a so-called timed edition. Like, there's a certain period of time where you can claim those prints. But, you know, this is something, and maybe that's right. And maybe, Derek, we'll kick it to you. This is an interesting example of an algorithm being expressed wholly from a collectability perspective as a physical. NFT, there's no certificate of authenticity or anything of that sort. I'd be curious through your eyes if that's instructive or meaningful.
It is. So there's actually two constraints that I think about when I see work like this. The first is this constraint of artists knowing that whenever they mint something on chain, that work can be priced and traded and tracked in real time. And it also applies against their count, right? Like, the more objects that they have on a blockchain, the more they have, you know, surface area to be priced by an open global marketplace. And there's a lot of artists who want to make sure that they're dropping work on chain that's conducive to, like, the growth of scale that they feel most comfortable with. Mm-hmm. Dropping tens of thousands of objects that are all unique and generative may not be part of Mappon's count in terms of his, like, plan to grow as an artist over the next two decades. With that said, there's this other constraint around visibility and networking of an object. And so I wrote about this in my piece, Storing Value in Digital Objects. The holy grail is really making something hyper collectible on this blockchain-based network while also making it incredibly networked as a collection. And I think QQL demonstrated this last year. I think Tyler really pioneered this model, which is, can you network a collection? And in that case, I think 10 million off-chain outputs were generated through, like, the parameters that people were able to, like, play around with off-chain, and only 1,000, you know, mint passes existed against the collection. Now, the collection ended up doing quite well. I think he generated $17 million in a few hours, but tens of millions of, you know, outputs have been generated off-chain, which is really, like, it got a lot of people involved and networked the collection.
When you say network the collection, what you're, just to tell people what you mean there, is you're saying you're basically creating a mechanic that allows for exploration and social spread of the content without there being an increase in supply actual mint.
Exactly right.
So because it's free, like, marketing, basically.
It's attention. Yeah, and it's, like, attention is the root of all value. And this is, like, the argument of the piece that I wrote. And so this is a brilliant way to make something, you know, networked with attention while also hyper limiting like the amount of outputs that are on chain and for sale through that vehicle.
Yeah.
And so I'm a huge fan of like off-chain networking in conjunction with on-chain objects.
And here's the cool thing about this one is now, okay, I went, I played, I don't want to spend the whatever it ends up being, 10 grand for a mint pass. And I'm like, okay, well, I spent, you know, a few hours, gosh, $650, and I can get a signed one of one straight from a pawn.
It's pretty awesome.
And it doesn't add to his overall digital collection art, you know, like supply. That's amazing.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, it's a really cool mechanic. I'm actually surprised we haven't seen more artists do this. I think the model was very successful in many ways for what Tyler was doing. Obviously, there were things about QQL. It was a very, you know, like people could really fiddle with the knobs and imbue themselves in the work. And I think some people would push back against that. But the mechanic of being able to explore an algorithm off-chain, I think is something that I'd like to see more often. And like these vehicles for off-chain posters that are signed and additioned by the artist, I think this is just one way to achieve that kind of networking.
Yeah, very cool.
My little plug for our Algo Explorer, we have one on the Proof site too for anything that's on the Artblocks engine platform. So we have that, and it's been a lot of fun to kind of play around with. I think it's an interesting thing because especially with generative art, you have this almost like forced scarcity by just picking a random edition size, right? To be able to open this up to prints, what do you think it sort of does to this idea of forced scarcity for generative art and then the importance of it actually being on chain? Like for me, I think from $650 for a print that is yours, it's something that you generated, to almost like more than $5,000 for it to just be fungible, kind of. What's that like? What is that like? Is there a huge disconnect here on pricing and importance? Does this feel like also more for scarcity? Like, what do you kind of think about this whole idea? There's something about it that like, there's something there. I just don't know really quite what that thought is, but what do you guys think?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great point because it makes you really have to answer the question to yourself internally. Do I care about having the NFT?
Mm-hmm.
Because in some sense, I'm getting the output of the code that is stored on the blockchain, and I'm having this actual physical, which I love. Because let's face it, most of us don't have digital displays at home.
Yeah,
and at this price point, and it's signed, like that's why I'm not paying the crazy money for the NFT. Because like honestly, like I want to walk around my house and experience the art. And you know, we may have one digital frame, but like, for me, in this time, this period of time, in this down market, like this is a fantastic price point. And and we've seen this before with Damien Hirst, right?
Yeah.
With the burn, right?
Yes.
I opted for the physical.
You did.
And I love my physical. I got it. I have it hanging up in my office and I can flip it over and see the back and see the addition and the little imprint that they did. And I don't know, there's something about that tangible physical that I really like and prefer.
There's almost a premium for degeneracy. Like there's almost a premium for being able to resell it, you know, at some point, right? There's a massive premium there.
Sam, one thing that
I thought, you know, we're seeing almost every drop right now is including some sort of physical. I mean, it's just become this huge new trend in art NFTs. And I thought that maybe that was a sign that people just aren't as interested in digital ownership right now. And that, you know, as a substitute, they want the physicals. But I think that this auction is showing us the opposite. You know, I mean, you have the 60 NFTs right now going for $5,100. They could be, if people just wanted the physical, you could just buy one, you know, for $650. People are ultimately paying 9x that. So I think that like the marketplace here is telling us that there is still a lot of demand for digital scarcity and digital collectibles. And I think that's kind of cool to see in this outcome. I always just love to sit back and see how the marketplace treats these things differently. Like if you look at Jack Butcher Elements, you know, the ones with the physical trade at double the price of just the NFT. So each collection shows you a different thing about the marketplace and buyers and sellers. But I think we're seeing a real strong kind of statement here that people want that digital scarcity.
Yeah, the one last thing I just will add is that it is nice that you can be a fan of this drop and you can say, I still have a way to own a piece of it, even if I'm not paying the high dollar mark for the actual NFT, right? Yep. Which is really cool.
Yeah.
All right, so we have to move on. We've got souvenirs by Matt Cain, the action figure. We got to show. We have to show this one and talk about this for a second.
We do. We spent so much time talking about Matt Cain a couple of episodes ago. The work that he did.
I just can't. This is amazing. Sorry.
I think this is an extension of the critique. It's very clear that like he's packaging up like a consumer product. It's very much like the lowest common denominator. It's like you see what you get. You know, this is, you know, speaking towards how he feels as an artist, the type of work that he's serving to the general public. You know, there's some playful dynamics he made. I think Sam flagged this earlier in the episode. Depending on how you've engaged with contractual obligations as a collection, whether you continued to hold it without listing it or selling it, whether you sold it, with royalties or without royalties, you have received a different type of consumer product.
So that's the one. If you did not pay royalties, you receive, which is the ripped apart,
just an empty one.
Just an empty one. But what's actually funny is this is the more rare one.
Yeah, it is. It's the whole thing is just it's very playful and like very interesting. And you know, like how many of these are there? A handful, five, six of them. So you know, like there is something that's inverted about this mechanism that he created, where the folks who were, you know, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and didn't sell the piece are left with the edition size that is definitely
did
a greater
you get
supply.
One of these?
I do. Yeah, I got one. Yeah.
And you didn't pay royalties, so you get the ripped off one.
Well, no. I kept mine. I love this piece.
That's
yeah.
awesome.
But yeah, it's interesting.
Sorry, I think you're salty, Derek, that you got the one that for your loyalty you were rewarded with the least rare NFT.
Well, I'm here for the ride. Like, I am here for the creative expression and the artistic experiment. I was never going to sell the action figure either way. So I'm happy to be supportive of Matt. And this has just been a fun journey to be on.
This is one where I want the physical. I'd love to have a little tiny little Matt game. It's amazing.
It would be fun to talk to, just quickly, it'd be fun to talk to Matt to know if this was pre-planned, if this was sort of part of the idea from concept and from the jump, or if this is a very quick reaction to the reaction to the initial drop. My instinct is it's probably the latter, and that Matt is just so creative that he observed the reaction in the market from collectors, and this was his riff on that, which is impressive, which is fun, and I'm excited to see what follows after this, because Sam mentioned it. He has another auction ongoing at the moment. He's just prolific in terms of his expression of the whole thing.
Well, here's the fun thing, Eli, and tell me if you agree with this or not. I'd be curious what everyone thinks. Is like when I thought of Matt Cain for the last, like, call it year, or you know, when he really started to pop, I thought of a very distinct style.
100%.
Like, you know, where you go to Super Rare and you'd see, or you see Gazers, or you see the Doors, or you look at them and you're like, oh, that's Matt Cain. And then all of a sudden he just broke, like something snapped and he just went crazy and started doing all this. And I love it. It's like Matt Cain off the rails. Like he's just going nuts in all these different directions. And it feels like he's really opened up and just gone mad.
I think what's brilliant about this is like when you would go to Super Rare, you would see Gazers or you would interact with this piece. There was the surface level understanding of what was happening. And then there was this deep rooted technical complexity that existed across all of his work. And it feels like that same complexity now exists, but it's not on the technical side. It's on like this social commentary side where like what you see is surface level, but like there's all of this embedded context within it that I think is, it's been really interesting to parse out and interact with. And it just shows his flexibility as an artist and a creative.
Yeah. It's awesome.
The other thing I find kind of interesting here is we have been talking, you know, I think that removing royalties has hurt the ecosystem. And I think that the artist collector alignment's a little bit less there. I think, you know, financially artists are now incentivized more to get as much out of the initial drop as they can because you don't quite grow with the collection as much. But we've talked about all the different things you can do to reward people who pay royalties and just the different ways that with the tech kind of lacking the ability to enforce, you can do things as an artist or as a collection to reward royalties and otherwise. And I thought, like, I don't think this is like you know, this isn't like creating some big difference, but it was interesting to see a first stab at that. Someone taking a go at like, we're going to like give a bit of a nerfed NFT to the guys who didn't pay royalties, a bit of that. Yeah. Maybe a little bit of a mark of shame. I don't even know. That's probably the wrong way to describe it, but this is one of the first things we've seen kind of pushing that forward. And, you know, I imagine we'll see more efforts of that kind of in the future.
Yeah. I love that. It is fun. It's because no one loses here. It's like, you get a one that's scraped up and ripped off, but it wasn't like that big of an FU. It was just kind of like, okay, if you paid royalties, you get a slightly cooler version of this, you know?
Yeah.
All right. So Amanda, audience questions.
We still have some people talking about, you know, the benefits of printing and digital. I think it's really interesting. You know, somebody, Gaz, says, you know, I wonder how many NFTs that come with physicals are sold on secondary that actually include the physical. So I think that's the question about how hard it is to track when they are kind of combined in that way. So I think that, you know, being able to kind of decouple those things in this case is actually kind of good. So I think that, let me see. I think that's really it. Some slide tooth, agrees with you, Sam, that Blur, well, he didn't say this, but he says Blur killed everything. I think it has something to do with royalties as well on what that kind of affected the market.
I didn't say Blur killed everything. I just said that the loss of royalties has made things harder. Let's get my words straight. I don't want people coming at me.
He said Blur killed most things, not everything. Just kidding. It's true.
Everyone is still kind of on that. And I think, you know, you and I were talking about this, Sam, like people are actually really interested in this sort of physical versus digital thing. And I think a lot of people are just kind of still talking about that because this is a very kind of pivotal time right now. I think, you know, it feels like, you know, what did Dort say earlier? That he prefers something that's a little bit more digitally native compared to something that kind of just looks like trad art. And so I think it's an interesting time right now where you'll see kind of two camps of like, I want digital only. I think it was Aaron who said you can't fit a print on your ledger, right? Like there's some people who want that. And then some people who kind of want to feel something. So it's kind of starting some interesting conversations here and at least giving us some more options for what we do with our NFTs. So that's cool.
Yeah. Awesome.
I also liked what Akeen said on the market talk. Akeen from, one of the great kind of contributors to the community. And he was talking about just how a lot of these physical prints opens the door to a whole new group of collectors. Obviously, yeah. I mean, I think Verse is really targeting people who want to go to galleries in London, people who want to be in those galleries. And this gives them an entryway into the space where they can collect these artists that are native to the NFT ecosystem and, you know, hopefully become bigger collectors within the ecosystem. But I thought that was an interesting kind of thing that Akeen pointed out yesterday.
Yeah, that's a great point because you can see it on your wall and say, hey, this was an algorithm. This was actually an NFT. And for someone that doesn't know the first thing about NFTs, they're like, wow, these can be physical as well, which is kind of cool.
I mean, is it technically an NFT? It's not. It's just like blockchain art, I guess. Like if it goes straight to a print.
It's not even blockchain art. It's just algorithm art.
Algorithm art. Yeah, it's not even an NFT at all. Like that's an interesting way. Yeah. Somebody said, Gabriel said, funny if these physicals are eventually thrown into a real world vault, tokenized and ended up trading on the blockchains anyway. Like we might just come right back to that.
So true. So true.
Just throw an IYK badge on it and we're good to go.
All right. Well, we are really lucky today to be joined by Luke and Jesse here, one remote and one in studio. I'll throw it over to Eli to have a conversation.
Yeah, sounds good. So welcome. So Jesse Wolston and Luke Shannon, two of the three artists in our Notes of a Neutron Star release happening next week. Welcome, guys. Oh, I cannot hear
hey,
Jesse.
There we go. Can you hear me? This works?
Yeah, yes. I got you both. Okay, all amazing. Right. Welcome.
Cool.
It's funny that, Jesse, you are in studio with Dirt, Amanda, and Kevin, and I'm over here, but we're making it work.
It's wild, but it's good to be here. Fun. You know, I'm at an arm's length. Hello, everyone.
But through the magic of cameras, you'll never know.
Exactly.
You'll never
know how close
you are, but we are right here.
All right, so let's jump in. We're going to talk about a variety of things, and then maybe you know we'll ultimately get to the work that you guys have contributed as part of this release. But I wanted to sort of go back and start with audio as a theme very briefly. you know, the work that you created and the discussions we all initially had was around this work from Joy Division and Peter Saville. I'd be curious, maybe for both of you, how does audio inform your work and your creative process?
Luke, you want to go first? I'm gonna throw you on the bus. Huh? Yeah.
It's okay. You go first. The next one.
Okay, sounds good. We'll tag team.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it's a huge inspiration. Like, generative music has always been a big inspiration for me. It's what I listen to when I'm producing work. But also, more generally, I see a lot of parallels in terms of the performative aspect. I see generative art very much as a performance and kind of a co-creation, because it's only exists through the act of the viewer, the collector, kind of like you guys are talking about with Williams' drop. And that's very similar to a performance, where a performance, if you don't have an audience, that's like a rehearsal and not a performance the way it's trying to be. So that is something that I try to work on a lot in my work. And it actually leads me to do a lot of music projects specifically too. Like I'm doing a music video right now. I've done some album covers. Mm-hmm. I was actually kind of briefly a part of a band as a live coder for it. So I would like live code generative visuals during a concert. So they were up on stage and I was like on the side with my computer. And I even live plotted a concert one time, which was even crazier. Like the plotter was on the side working. So, there's a lot of loves for me, but it's like really great to combine them, I think.
Yeah. Fascinating. And Jesse, for you, I know I've heard you mention that your work is informed by music, philosophy, and visual art. You sort of bring those pieces together. Talk to us about that a little bit, and then maybe sort of your experience as a composer, the way it all fits together in the work that you're producing now.
Yeah, I mean, throughout the history of my art and what I've been doing, I've always found that like the visual material by itself doesn't really contextualize exactly what I'm trying to produce in terms of like an emotional context. And I find that with the visual components, like this instantaneous, you know, slam of like beauty and aesthetics and motion in my case, but there's not a whole lot of stasis that comes with music. So throughout my life, mm-hmm. I'm a composer and a sound designer, and I've really tried to like articulate and understand like what are the emotional weights or the concepts that I can channel through the music that pairs with a visual. So if I'm going to sit down, I'm like, okay, I'm going to write a piece that feels this specific way. I'm also trying to write it in a way that is based in that philosophy or that concept. So I'm like, okay, if I'm going to have a lead line, that lead line needs to be supporting the visual material or the philosophy of the work. And then further, I mean, one thing I've been obsessed with my whole life is trying to like break down and understand nature and the universe, but also human beings. So I'm like, okay, why do we feel these certain ways when we hear this interval or this composition? But also further than that, like what about sound design? Like, okay, how does the air work? And how do I kind of manipulate that based on things you'll pay attention to based on our evolutionary arc? So I'm kind of like, I try to put everything together as this experience that someone can, you know, when they observe my work, they can get a sense of emotional feeling that articulates the work, but also the visual is very instantaneous and does the job too. So it's a marriage between those two qualities.
Yeah, so let's double click into that for a moment, Jesse, and talk sort of more broadly about the physical experience and some sort of co-creation between yourself and the viewer of your work. Oftentimes your work is shown in very large format, large scale, and we're doing our best to show it in that way, both in London and there at the Foundry over the following or coming next couple weeks. Talk about that importance of the physical, of the sort of tactile experience, someone located in a space, experiencing the work. Just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, thank you for asking that, by the way. It's amazing. So, I mean, yeah, I'm one of those like old people where it's like, if I could only have someone experience my work in a room with a giant, you know, piece of artwork, that would be the most ideal. And the reason why like I'm very much into large scale installations in that size is I'm actually like, on a personal note, I'm chasing a feeling that I've gotten when I've been running around New Zealand and I've felt intimidated and fearful of nature. So there's this quality with my work where I'm trying to like subvert the feeling of nature in an honest way, where it's supposed to be intense, it's supposed to be intimidating, it's supposed to be kind of fearful, but I want to make it beautiful. You know, I want to have this experience with this large scale piece in front of a human being or a viewer, where they get this sense of like, okay, this is a mix of emotion. I feel this intensity, but I feel it's, you know, it's beauty. And I think that really kind of hits the nail of what I want to create. And, you know, my aspirations and my goals is to have every single person that experiences my work to stand in front of it with that large scale. So hopefully one day you and I will be standing in front of a giant digital tsunami and I'll be like, this is it. You know, that's kind of the goal.
Yeah.
That physical space I think is also really important because it imposes itself much more on the viewer. You know, because we're used to digesting artworks now, at least on devices and laptops and phones. And that's a very safe thing. You have a lot of control over it. But when you walk into a room and there's a giant piece of artwork there, you're like, oh, okay, I'm kind of secondary in this space to this art piece. Mm. So I think environmental design, how something is built to be experienced, is just as important as the artwork, which is why I'm stoked that, you know, we've been doing events together and the work is up at the Foundry.
Yeah. Hey, and then Luke, for yourself, I mean, of course, bringing your digital and code-based work into the physical is also something you've done a lot of and is a part of your practice, whether that is with prints and the plotter, and you mentioned sort of live plotting as part of performance, but also textiles and stitching and physicals. I saw you and Marfa at Art Blocks and you were experimenting with some of those mediums. Talk about sort of taking your code-based work and bringing it into the physical in a few ways in which you've expressed that.
Yeah, I see algorithms, computer algorithms, not as an abstraction of the computer, but very much as living things, things that surround us. And so it feels natural to me to try to make physical things guided by those algorithms. And because the code, because everything kind of all machines for these kinds of fabrications speak code at some level, it's really amazing what you're able to do and get really low level control and reveal something about the system of the machine too, how it works internally. And so those are like the two of the really compelling reasons that I want to make physical work as well. And sorry, what was the second part of the question?
No, talk about a couple of those manifestations of that physical loop. Yeah, playing with stitching and all sorts of things.
Yeah. So I've done the most work probably with the plotter. I think it's what most generative artists go for first. And it's a really fantastic tool to use, and is like the first display too, like before computers had displays or printers, like we were using plotters. So it's a really great way to start with that. But I've experimented more with embroidery, like you've been saying. I have some experiments with CNC that I'm working on, with 3D printing, metal 3D printing, laser cutting. Like pretty much every time I like see a new way I can try to make something, textiles, weaving, Jacquard looms, also early computers. I try to push that and see what I can reveal about that system.
I love that. And Luke, I read that, so you are a researcher and artist resident at the Science and Technology Center at Princeton. Did I get that right, first of all?
Not currently, but I was, yeah, for a little bit. And I was doing a lot of embroidery.
Oh, interesting. So, so what were you doing? What were you doing there? I'm just fascinated.
So there's a really great, makerspace kind of area at Princeton. I mean, they have a fantastic set of tools and machines that I can work with in code. And so I was doing a lot of that already, and then reached out to some people about kind of formalizing it. And so I had a summer basically of time in that space, just me like working with these machines, and was able to do some experiments that I'm really proud of like really large scale plotting, embroidery, these kinds of things. And also like advise a little bit on new techniques for embroidery and machinery that, you know, like they could use in the future, new ways to use it, that kind of thing.
Oh, fascinating. Okay, let's track ahead a little bit and talk about the work that you guys have created as part of this release. Jesse, maybe starting with you, you know, you described the way that you investigate new ideas, the way in which there are these different conceptual underpinnings of your work. I'm curious, in this case, with this sort of prompt or this sort of additional element external to yourself as something to reflect on, meaning Peter Saville's work, how did you begin the process of incorporating that influence into ultimately this work that you're contributing here, Instability, as part of the show?
Yeah, I think like one thing whenever I consider a collaboration or I come in and I'm supposed to honor somebody else's work and someone that came before me, I consider like, all right, what was the function or the point, or like what was Peter really digging into? And then how can I almost extend that or express more of that or show people like the essence of what he was trying to grasp? And obviously, like, you know, the artwork has been iconic for a very, very long time. And I loved it because it's, you know, based on the Pulsar Star. So I was like, okay, that's a brilliant prompt. You know, I love the universe in terms of breaking it down and, you know, and basically trying to understand it and then simulate it in beautiful ways. So what I did was, is I was like, okay, how can I figure out to extend this idea and that inspiration? So what the simulation is actually about and what it's, you know, focused on is, when a star dies, the gravitational weight of it outruns the fuel that is being expressed, and then it implodes and explodes. Mm. And what happens in that, you know, in the supernova event is it sheds its outer layer, and as it does that, all of the gases and the dust and the materials express outward. And with different temperatures and densities, you get all this mixing of this, you know, of this these gases. And that's what the simulation is all about. It's a 2D cut in half expression of that universal law. So if you look at pulsars, if you look at the Crab Nebula, which, you know, the image, the iconic image by NASA, that is a part of that expression is actually the simulation that I've built. So I'm like, okay, how can I really dig into what he was looking at, Peter, but then also show more of that beauty that comes with a pulsar and a supernova event, and obviously the neutron star is the encompassing classification for that. So that's really what it was. I really wanted to dig into, like, all right, how do I understand the universe more? How can I express its beauty? How can I take all this crazy complexity that happens with these cosmic bodies and simplify it down and create something beautiful with it? So that's why it's called Instability. It's a nod and a very on the nose love letter to the Rayleigh Taylor instabilities, which is how you mathematically quantify those behaviors, those gases. Yeah,
it's fascinating, man. And I so appreciate the depth with which you're investigating those themes. It's really interesting. Jesse, you've been very thoughtful about the number of works that you make available for sale. I'm curious myself, how do you think about that? You know, I'm sure you've had many opportunities to do open editions and other editioned work. You've only, I think, done one of ones and only four to date. How do you think about sort of the cadence and type of work that you release for sale?
I mean, you know, what works for me is really creating as high octane or potency as I can whenever I do something. So if I'm going to do an installation or a collaboration or a NFT or a one of one, I'm like, okay, this has to be absolutely dialed in every area possible. Because I look at my one of ones as almost like the seedlings to the larger areas of my practice. So if I do a singular piece, that is going to turn into an installation and things like that. And I'm also planning on, you know, I'm really trying to look ahead to the next 70 years if I'm going to be around that long, hopefully. But, you know, so I'm trying to think of like, okay, how do I plan for the future? And then each one of one I release, each piece I put out, I'm starting to slowly build the universe around those pieces. So the people that own those and the support I get, I can really start to transition to something much larger than myself. So it's really just this combination of like, I want to go slow, I want to be intentional, I want to go 70 years, you know, and I don't want to mess that up, you know, so I'm like, I'm going to be more careful about what I do. Not saying that obviously open editions and whatnot is bad, I'm just like, what works for me is this really high potent approach to singular one of one, so yeah.
I love that. And we so appreciate that, you know, you're releasing one of those with us and you trust us in that relationship. Luke, let's go over to you. So your work as part of this show is called My First Plot, a very literal title for these works that literally are your first plots. Take us back to 2019 when you created these works and give us a little bit of that origin story.
Yeah, so this was my first experience with the plotter, borrowing a friend's plotter, like a vintage Roland, and like a very complicated path to make it all work. But it was amazing to me to be able to use it. And I think it's really interesting that my first plot, and I feel like actually speaking with other generative artists, a lot of artists' first work, first plotter work, is informed or some maybe even attempting to recreate in code Peter's work. And that's the case for me. Like, number one is a very direct reference. So it is a cultural reference is really interesting to me. I think that it says a lot about how open and new it was and still is. And yeah, I think the first experience with a new medium is a point for an artist where you can actually learn a lot about their work and themselves. Like, that's why I like to experiment with a lot of different media as well. You don't really know yet how to hide some of the things that you might want to hide. So it's like a very personal work. So it was great to revisit that series, and like think about how I was thinking about, generative art at that time. Like, I'm interested in unlearning and inhabiting the mind of a beginner, where options and ideas can be more open and there's fewer preconceptions, in a sense, fewer biases. So yeah, it was really special to like come back to these works after so long.
Yeah, I mean, this is very special to have these four first plots from you, Luke, and the physicals connected to the NFTs. This, I mean, dovetails with much of our discussion today about having these physical expressions of this code-based work so that people can live with the work in a slightly different way than if it's just wholly digital. And you two, as we've been talking through, Jesse and Luke, the two of you are expressing your work in these interesting mediums, this diversity of ways that really allows a collector and all audiences to experience them in such compelling manners. So love the way that you're both pushing boundaries in very different ways, right? In almost wholly different ways in some respects, but perhaps with a common outcome in some cases in terms of the viewer and what they experience as a result. So just to reiterate, next Thursday, October 26th, the sale for Notes of a Neutron Star opens with Luke Shannon, Jesse Wolston. This has been great, guys. I appreciate it so much and excited for next week.
Thank you.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Great to have those guys on the show.
Great interview.
Yeah, fantastic work too. Really cool stuff. All right, so it is time to move on to our giveaway.
Yeah, and kind of related. So hopefully you guys were all kind of paying attention. Loved hearing about Luke's first plot. Does anyone remember the year that he made that? First person to get that answer will win a signed hat from Kevin and Justin.
I'm not signing.
And I'll do a little something in there too. There it is. Stu.art. Stu. 2019.
Let's go, Stu.
All right, Stu. We're going to put together a good little care package. I promise it's not just going to be some hat, some old hat. We'll put together an awesome little package of good stuff. We got all kinds of stickers and pins and we got all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. For sure. It'll be fun. Congrats.
Awesome. All right. Well, this has been an awesome episode.
Loved it.
So much art happening right now.
It's awesome. It's really cool. I also, like, secretly, my favorite part of these episodes every week is getting to hear Eli or Sam interview some of the great artists making work right now. I mean, it's great to get that context and that depth of knowledge around how work was created. And I just get to sit here and listen to it. It's awesome.
Yeah. Very, very cool. Well, Everyone have a great week. This has been another episode of 100 Proof Live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific. And we'll broadcast on Twitter and YouTube per usual. Subscribe, tell your friends, and we will see you next Friday.
Let's go.
See you.
Party Sam.
Let's go. Let's go.